You're lucky.
I know. The House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water will come to order. Happy Valentine's Day, everybody, and happy Oregon's birthday. We are going to start with an informational meeting on SCR 208. And for folks in the room, this is a very packed committee room. There's a lot of things on the agenda today. We're going to try to move quickly. But for this first portion here, I would really urge everybody to be respectful during this testimony. It's a very important issue. We want to honor somebody very important. And if you could take conversations out into the hall, we'd really appreciate it. So with that, Mr. Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and Co-Chair Gilliam. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro, and I have just a very brief comments to introduce this topic. First of all, I'd like to thank you very sincerely for allowing us to have this informational hearing today when people are already down in the Capitol. I appreciate your courtesy. I am here for two purposes beyond that. One is I'd like to introduce By the way, SCR 208 honors Steve Apotheker. He was a colleague of ours at Metro for 13 years, but he was ever so much more than that. He was a national leader in recycling, as you'll hear from others. I would just like to introduce Steve's family, his wife, Diane Meisenhelter, right here, and his daughter, Jessie Meisenhelter. Welcome. And I would also like to, I've had distributed to you more paper than Steve would be happy about. But I want to just tell you what it is, and then I'll be finished with my portion. There's a letter from the Metro Council thanking you for this opportunity to honor Steve. There's an article that appeared in the Oregonian. It was a very large article that appeared on the front of the living section after he passed away. There's an editorial in Resource Recycling Magazine, where Steve worked for many years, an editorial that says, an exception for Steve, because as it begins, it notes that they don't do memorials in Resource Recycling Magazine, but they made an exception for, in this case. Something that appeared, to my surprise, I'm not sure if anyone else knew it was coming, in the Portland Monthly at the end of last year, which mentioned several major figures who had passed away during the year, including Mark Hatfield and Betty Roberts and people like that, but also wanted to point out others who changed Portland and changed the region in lesser known but equally important ways. And there's Steve Apotheker right there, along with several other people. And finally, there's Steve's final article that he published in Resource Recycling Magazine. We wanted you to have that as well. So I appreciate the opportunity to submit these for the record, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair Bailey, Mr. Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee, we're very pleased to be here before you. My name is Jim Desmond, and I'm the director of Metro Sustainability Center, which is the department in which Steve worked, and where we oversee the regional solid waste reduction efforts, recycling, conservation education, and natural resource protection. The last thing Steve would have wanted is a bunch of people here talking about him, the person. He would have preferred we talk about his issues, but to recognize him, I do want to introduce Steve a bit to you. Steve Apotheker was the model public employee. He exerted great leadership, not through the position that he held, but through his very deep and nationally recognized subject matter expertise around solid waste reduction. Steve was a worker bee. He was in the trenches where he could make the biggest difference. He was always seeking continuous improvement and modeling best practices. He was the agency nudge. You frequently got notes, and if you were a senior manager like myself or Michael Jordan, who was then our chief operating officer, you frequently got notes from Steve with information on how we could do a better job. Pretty good was never good enough for Steve. But he was also never a sideline critic. He was a problem solver who would find opportunities and proactively cross barriers. Often when he came to see me about something, he would anticipate what the difficulties were, and he would have solutions for every one of them when he presented a new idea of how we could improve our recycling efforts or solid waste reduction efforts. And he was always aware of the best new approaches across the globe. He was a tremendous student of the technical issues. He was aware of all new technologies, but also new funding sources, and was able to leverage the taxpayer dollars very effectively. Steve made the seemingly impossible possible. He also founded and led Metro's Enact and Green Teams, where Metro walked its own talk and modeled best practices at our own facilities, including the Oregon Zoo and the LEED certified award-winning Oregon Convention Center. Steve inspired his peers and served as Metro's moral compass. If you walk through our building today, you'll see numerous workstations that have a photo of Steve Apotheker with a caption that was a favorite expression of his, know what is right, do what is right. He won numerous local, state, and national awards that are outlined in your resolution, including the Recycler of the Year by the National Recycling Coalition and also a Lifetime Achievement Award from the same organization. In an era where public employees are widely distrusted by the public, Steve Apotheker set a standard for excellence and commitment to public service. In my 17 years in public service, I've never seen one individual have this much tangible and positive impact. So on behalf of everyone at Metro and our local partners, the 25 cities across the region and the three counties, we appreciate your consideration of this recognition of a one-of-a-kind man and an exemplary public employee. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You may want to pull the microphone over to you here.
Yes. Thank you. Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam. I'm member of the committee. I'm Peter Spendelo, representing the Department of Environmental Quality, actually. Get to represent us for once. But I was asked to I was honored to be asked by Metro to come here to talk about Steve. But actually, because we worked a lot together, waste composition study, recycling studies, a whole lot of different things, the bottle bill task force, which a number of you participated in. But actually, I'm going to do what Jim said that Steve would want us to do, which was he didn't want us to come here and talk about him. He really wanted us to talk about the debate about what makes Oregon sustainable and how we can get to be more sustainable. It was mentioned to you that as his health was declining, he took some time out to write an article for Resource Recycling magazine. Article is called Moving Towards Sustainability, and you have copies of that now. And I just wanted to give you the 4 points that he gave there, because I think that's actually the best way we can honor Steve, is by telling you what his work is. Again, this is Steve's views. They're not DEQ's views necessarily, although we certainly have learned a lot from Steve, too. His first point is that we really need to be honest about recycling. Recycling does provide large environmental benefits, but only does so when you're actually replacing virgin resources, when you're not having to use as much energy to dig up things, cut down things to make materials. And so if all you're doing is simply diverting things from landfill, say, using it in roadbed material, you're not really saving much in the way of resources. You really need to be honest about things like that. And if you're collecting materials but you're not properly sorting them out, not properly getting them to market, that's not helping anybody. That's wasting material. So he said you really need to be honest about that. The next thing is he said we need to change the model we have, and he'd like us to adopt a stewardship model, both from the standpoint of the producers so that they have, that they are setting up their products to be recyclable, reusable, meet certain standards, but government has a role in setting those standards, and he also thought that the public had a real role in stewardship, being responsible for the materials that they've purchased so that they properly handle those at the end of their life. The third thing is that he said we really should be managing resources, not managing discards, because it's the resources that are important when we are making materials or building houses or so on. It's the resources and the energy that's used. That's what's really important. If we just wait for the thing to be discarded at the end of its life, things like buildings, that might be years later. And there are a lot of things like food that we consume that, you never see that at the end of its life if you've consumed it. So we really need to be looking at resources. But fourth, I think, is probably the most important to him. He was thinking we really need to attain a sustainable level of resource use, consuming no more of our fair share of the resources than basically consuming our fair share of the world's resources and no more than that, and also making sure that we have resources available in the same quantity to pass on to future generations. He was a big proponent of the ecological footprint concept. He notes that Americans, on average, would take 23 acres for us to live sustainably, to be able to produce the goods we do and to absorb the carbon dioxide that we generate from heating our houses and our transportation. But he points out that, as we all know, that there's only 5.2 acres per person available if you take the total size of the Earth and divide it by the population. So if everybody would live like we would, we'd need 4.5 Earths to do that. And this was something really important. And he thought the way we should attract this is through the natural step framework, where you look to the future, you come up with a vision for the future, and then you figure out a path to get there. You backcast from there. And I just wanted to tell you that I know that Steve was disappointed the article didn't get a lot of discussion when he wrote it, But the community, Solid Waste Committee, has heard that. DEQ right now is doing an update of our, under mandate from the Oregon Legislature, we're updating our current Solid Waste Management Plan because it is out of date. And in doing so, we decided to concentrate on looking at materials over their whole life cycle, not just at the end of life. So we are calling it our Materials Management Plan. Plus, we're using the natural step framework, exactly what Steve was recommending in this article. We are having a vision for where we think solid waste should be in 2050, and then looking at backcasting from there. We have a large group who's working with us on trying to develop this vision. But what I think would make Steve smile most about this, if he looked, if we're able to look at it now, is what we've come up with in this vision. I wanted to read you one statement. And this is straight from the draft that we have out for public comment right now on our website from our vision. The statement reads as following. Recognizing the Earth's resources are finite, Oregonians live within the limits of our sustainable share of the world's natural resources. So that's the vision that we're looking for. That's the vision that we have out for public comment right now. And from his article, I really think that's the vision Steve would be really eager to discuss. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you making time, and thank you to the family for being here. This is, I believe we have one more person testify, so thank you.
As Meg Lynch comes up, I just wanted to note that Michael Jordan, Chief Operating Officer of the state, who used to be Metro's Chief Operating Officer, was going to be here and had got called up to the governor's office, but testified earlier and had some beautiful comments. So.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, and committee members. My name is Meg Lynch, and I work at Metro, the regional government in Portland, as a waste reduction manager. Steve and I worked together for 21 years, 13 years at Metro, and 8 years at Resource Recycling Magazine, which is a national trade journal. It's been an honor and a privilege and a joy to work with him as his colleague and his friend. I miss him deeply. Those of us in the recycling field look to Steve to analyze and present data clearly and simply and honestly. He developed game-changing policies, and he broke new grounds in recycling, waste prevention, and materials management. And he was not just a highly effective colleague. He was, as you've heard from other people, he was a visionary. He inspired us to think more deeply and more rigorously about the work we do. He reminded us that, he liked to say, we're not going to be able to recycle our way out of this. And that by this he meant the impacts of overconsumption of materials and natural resources. He was the first person I knew who talked seriously about sustainability and ecological footprint in a way that I could understand. His persistence was legendary, and although he never stopped pointing out to us what the right thing to do was, he never condescended to us or hectored us who were slower on the uptake. His influence was felt locally, regionally, and nationally, as evidenced by the awards that he's received. His colleagues were more proud of him than he probably was of himself when he got those awards. We respected him for his commitment, his integrity, his intellectual leadership, but we loved him for the person that he was. Kind, considerate, gentle, self-effacing, patient, non-judgmental, and very, very witty. His essential goodness was part of his DNA. It's been 7 months since Steve died, and a day does not go by when he doesn't come to my mind. An article I want to share with him, his brain to pick on a topic, what do you think about plastics to fuel, a pun that would make him groan, a conversation we should have about our families. At the end of the day, we can say that the earth, however briefly it was graced with Steve's presence, is a better place because he was in it and because he worked so assiduously to protect it. And those of us who had the honor and privilege of knowing him and working with him are smarter and better people because of him. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. We appreciate your time and coming down here to honor him. And with that, we thank everybody for the testimony. We will close the informational hearing on SCR 208. We look forward to hearing that resolution in the future. And we'll pass the gavel here.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We have the sign-up sheets, yes? I heard otherwise. But I don't know. There's a chance so many times. Okay, we'll say our goal.
Colleagues and friends in the room, we are going to hold public hearings on 4078, 4101, 4166. We're going to take a look at the sign-up sheets so that we can be as fair. Maybe we're okay. It's not.
This is page 2.
That one's got quite lengthy. So. We're going to begin with the public hearing on House Bill 4166, and I'll open that public hearing at this time. And I'd like to call all three folks that are here on this bill, Link Cannon, Dennis Creel, and Bill Cluding, if they'd come up. He is. Oh, and I didn't see my colleague, Representative Johnson. Do I still see his name?
No, I thought he was here.
What's going on?
Okay, we'll hear from Representative Johnson, but if you three would come forward and kick us off as other people would join you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Link Cannon. I work for the Oregon Forest Industries Council. I'd like to thank Representative Johnson and the sponsors for introducing this bill. The intent, although the language is perhaps not quite clear yet, the intent behind the bill is to correct an inequity in how green building certification systems treat Oregon wood, and it's been a national debate, and it's something that we think is worth having a conversation about in Oregon. And with that, I'd turn it over to Mr. Creel, who is with me, the Timberlands Manager for Hampton Resources.
And Mr. Creel, just before you do, I'm going to ask Beth if she'd give us the summary. I forgot
sure.
to do that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4166 would allow the Department of Energy to require an applicant seeking a tax credit certification to demonstrate if efficiency standards of energy conservation of the energy conservation project are eligible for certification under the specified forest product stewardship systems. It would apply to applications for preliminary certification after January 1st of 2013. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal, and it does have a subsequent referral to the Revenue Committee.
And Bill, if you want to come forward, Bill Cluding, take your seat, and please, Mr. Creel, proceed.
Okay, thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam and Co-Chair Bailey and members of the committee. I'm Dennis Creel. I want to thank you for allowing me to testify today in favor of House Bill 4166. I'm the timberland manager for Hampton Affiliates, a family-owned Oregon company headquartered in Portland. Hampton Affiliates employs about 1,600 people, primarily in Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. Hampton's annual lumber production capacity is in excess of 2 billion board feet, making us one of the largest software lumber manufacturers in the country. Hampton also has wholesale and distribution operations that deliver building products to customers all over the world. In Oregon, Hampton operates mills in Tillamook, Warrenton, and Willamina, with a combined capacity of 940 million board feet per year, and directly employs over 600 people with an annual payroll of $37 million. Hampton owns 91,000 acres of sustainably managed timberlands, and its wood procurement and land management systems are certified through the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, which is SFI. In addition, virtually all Hampton's logging contractors are professionally trained through SFI programs. Of the certified volume manufactured in Hampton's Oregon sawmills, 80% is certified under SFI, 19% under the American Tree Farm System, and less than a half a percent is certified under the Forest Stewardship Council FSC standards. SFI is the predominant certification system used by large private forest landowners in Oregon, while the American Tree Farm System provides certification to smaller family woodlots. As a result, most Oregon-produced lumber does not qualify for the same preferred treatment as FSC-certified wood under the LEED Green Building Standard. In contrast, Green Globes and most other national and international green building standards treat wood certified under SFI, ATFS, and FSC equally. In general, but particularly for an Oregon tax credit for energy efficient buildings, Hampton believes it is wrong to encourage green building systems that unfairly discriminate against Oregon forest products and manufacturers. HB 4166 takes a step in the right direction towards eliminating that inequality, and Hampton fully supports the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Bill.
Thank you, Co-Chair Bailey, Gilliam, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters Industrial Council. Years back, this kind of caught us off guard. We didn't understand LEEDS. We didn't know what LEEDS was, but all of a sudden we realized that LEEDS did not recognize. I don't think there was a single tree grower in this state that it recognized. But we found that we're bringing in foreign lumber from foreign countries. So we hit the ground running on this, and we've been running now all these years, and we haven't got it. I know all these terms are, it's hard to understand these terms, but my opinion is if any landowner in this state that follows the Oregon Practices Act, whether you're a little tree farmer, a big tree farmer, your lumber is just as good as anything in this world, and it should be allowed in any building. And if it is, they should fall in line for any tax credit that Oregon has online. Thank you.
Thank you. Our colleague is here, but before I bring him up, any questions for this panel? Colleague. Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony, all three. And Representative Johnson, if you've got a moment, we'd love to hear from you. And Rich, you can come up too for the in the interest of time.
Well, committee, thank you very much. For the record, Representative Mark Johnson, House District 52. I'll quickly try to shut off that higher ed portion of my brain and turn on this other part over here. It's just one of those days in this building. So,
no higher reasoning is necessary here, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you for your indulgence, and I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing on House Bill 4166. This issue, this bill, I think, gets to the overall question of how does Oregon define the concept of sustainability? The issue that we're going to have before us today came about from some of my experiences in the past as a school board member. In our Hood River County School Board, we passed a bond several years ago that allowed for the creation of some building of some new projects throughout our district. We did all kinds of energy efficiency measures to bring our buildings up to better standards, to save money and so forth, to make them better places for kids to learn. But we also went beyond that and actually took a shot at creating and building a net zero building, which we accomplished. And in the process of doing that, I got to learn a lot about the LEED energy certification standard. And one of the things that I was confused about was why our architects on this project wanted to continue to try to add such little tweaks or quirks, if you might, like bike racks, and why we might have needed to add just a little lean-to of a roof portion that they could put one particular solar panel on and so forth and so on. And as I asked questions, I began to understand about how LEED works, and that it's a certification system that's built on points. You get X number of points for doing specific things that lead to energy efficiencies, but also it goes beyond that. And as we were going to try to accomplish net zero, we had to take advantage of every little quirk we possibly could to get enough points. So As I began to investigate what credit lead gives to for specific behaviors and so forth, I began to look into how these points are awarded, and I began to find out that it's one of my concerns is that lead has a very restrictive view of how it awards points for the use of forest products. And the problem, the crux of the problem is that lead takes a very restrictive view of what type of forest certification standards it views favorably for forest products that get used in lead projects. And I'm not going to take the time to go through an entire primer on the entire issue here, but basically, within the forest product certification world, there are three main forest certification systems. You have one called Sustainable Forest Initiative, SFI. SFI was created to certify forests in North America. It only certifies forests in the United States and Canada. It is the largest single forest management standard in the world, with 195 million acres of certified lands in the United States and Canada. Most of our forests in Oregon are certified as SFI. Okay, they attain that. The one standard that LEED recognizes is called Forest Stewardship Council, or FSC. One of the problems is that while SFC can vary considerably from not just, it can vary considerably depending on what country you're in. FSC standards can vary between the U.S. and other countries, so it's entirely possible for FSC certified wood to be used. In order to attain credits under LEED, we could be importing wood from outside of the U.S. just to simply get point credits under the LEED standard. As we talk again, from a natural resource perspective, I don't think this is a very favorable aspect to have within our sustainability discussion. FSC certifications are variable, driven in part by a voting structure rather than differences in forests. As a result, certifications are not commercially responsible or reasonable in some places and often discriminate against good forest practices, such as those used here in the Pacific Northwest. And they can favor products from forest practices that are at least no better in other countries, such as Canada and Russia. This discussion, in the interest of time, and I understand you all are rushed, this discussion is happening not just in Oregon, but across the U.S. as states grapple with what does it mean to be green and still be able to use natural resources that we find within our states. And I think you have in front of you in the packet, I believe it was passed out, an executive order that was issued just late last year by the governor of the state of Maine, who made a statement and said, "The design, construction, operation, maintenance of any new or expanded state building shall incorporate green building standards that give certification credits equally to forest products grown, manufactured, and certified under all three of the following: the Sustainable Forestry Initiative, Forestry Stewardship Council, and the American Tree Farm System." And what we're asking for is that LEED begin to consider and to hold all of these forest certification systems equally, to not show preference one versus the other, because really if we're talking about if the net goal of a LEED certified building or one that's certified by any one of the other certification systems, there's LEED, Green Globes, and so forth, the type of wood that's used provides the same amount of insulation value, provides the same amount of structural value. But if we can be using products that actually are grown and manufactured here in Oregon, would that not make sense that it would have a net benefit to all of our wood products industries here in the state of Oregon and not discriminate and show preference to one type of system that really is a system that begins outside of the U.S. and is brought into here? So what I quickly want to walk you through then is the -4 amendments to House Bill 4166. I think the main body of the bill is very clear as it's written, and it simply says that if a project is new construction or a total retrofit of a building and has a structure that is composed primarily of forest products, the taxpayer may not use a LEED certification, Green Globes program rating, or a scoring by a program described in subsection, blah, blah, this section, to qualify the project for a tax credit under this section unless the LEED, Green Globes, or other program used to provide energy efficiency of the project allows the use of forest products and projects be evaluated under, and then it gives equal rating and treatment to Forest Stewardship Council lumber, the Sustainable Forestry Initiative lumber and wood products, and also the American Tree Farm System. All we're trying to accomplish here is to look at these forest certification systems equally and give them equal weight so that Oregon's wood products industry can have an equal shot in the sustainable projects that are qualifying for tax credits that we offer as a state to some of these projects. So, again, I would just leave you with these comments that I think Oregon needs to have a conversation about how we define sustainability. And I would make the further comments that I think a sustainable Oregon of the future must have a place for Oregon-grown, Oregon-manufactured, Oregon-produced natural resources. If we don't, I really don't think we're helping to advance our economy in the state. So with that, I will close. Be happy to answer any questions. But in closing, just let me say one other thing, and I think you're going to see that today, and that's why I'm excited to see this fellow sitting to my right. I think this issue is really helping to galvanize all of our natural resource industry proponents in this state. You'll hear from timber people, maybe you already have.
Yes.
Rich obviously represents OCAPA, which is a different part of our natural resource industry. But we need to come together to stand up for Oregon's natural resources and allow Oregon to determine what it is that makes us sustainable and not allow outside agency certifications to do that for us. So thank you, co-chairs. Thank you, committee, for your time.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. And you clearly were able to shift your thinking. And I want to tell you that I agreed and liked all three of your closes just now. And I'm glad you said all of them. I appreciate what you're trying to do here.
You know how an open mic is, Representative.
Yes, I do.
Now, Representative Krieger, my vice chair, has a question for you.
Who develops or sponsors LEADS?
LEADS is an international standard. It doesn't have its roots in the U.S. So there's a lot of proponents that probably would have a difficult time identifying Oregon on a map.
Please.
The reason I say that, there was a time I was on the American Tree Farm System Executive Board when we were national tree farmers. Just 2 weeks ago, they're coming out and recertifying, doing an amendment to the forest plan to see that you're upgrading, that you're meeting all those standards. You know, Oregon had the first Forest Practices Act. We use adaptive management and new sciences as we move forward. I cannot think of any state that was out in front faster, and that included the industrial landowners. They recognized protecting the environment, doing the things for water were all important. And I can remember when we were trying to say that if you were a member of the American Tree Farm System, Oregon Small Woodlands, that in itself, if you were following the rules, should suffice. And if you look at what we do, in my mind, that it does take care of the environment. You know, we've had the tree farm system in place, I think, since 1940 or 41. And to say that it isn't good enough is ridiculous. I'm having to update mine now. But what happened, I think it needs to be part of the conversation. When we did the certification and walked around, I knew it was happening. But all of a sudden, I've got 2 to 3 million feet of timber that I have to cut because it'll be too big for the infrastructure and the mills.
Mm-hmm.
And that was caused by the environmental for-profit industry.
I appreciate those comments, Representative Krieger. I agree. You know, the Forest Practices Act governs virtually all the certifications in Oregon already, which have some very strict standards about land management, replanting, reforestation, all of that. So the irony is that, as I said, Forest Stewardship Council, the standard can vary from country to country. You can go to Northern Europe and you can see some just devastated forest lands that has FSC's blessing. You can do the same thing going to New Zealand. Things that you cannot get away with here because we have a state standard that governs that trumps everything else.
One more little comment.
Absolutely.
All the biscuit fires in my district now. And I went up there with my granddaughter during hunting season. Compared to what it was when I got there in 64, the biscuit fire, if that was private property, you would be in violation of the Oregon Forest Practice Rules from one end to the other, from roads to lack of reforestation and protecting water values and soil values. But yet, nothing's happening. Guess who's causing that?
Thank you, Mr. Vice Chair. Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative, I appreciate you raising the issue and bringing it before the committee. Not to get into a slight technical debate on the record, but I do feel the need to correct one point that was made. The LEED, without an S, LEED standard, is actually a standard created by the United States Green Building Council. It's an American standard. It's not an international standard. In fact, it's not recognized in most other countries. And the Cascadia Green Building Council, which is the Oregon chapter of the United States Green Building Council, is actually their most active chapter. And they are quite active within the state and is one of their most active states. So I want to make sure that as we talk about the work that the USGBC has done and that LEED has done, that we are confining our discussion to, I think, a very appropriate debate about how timber is certified within that system. But it is not an overall indictment of good people who work at U.S. Green Building Council.
Correct. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Other comments or questions? If not, we're going to move on, and we thank you for your testimony, Representative. And Rich, if you can stay with us, you're welcome. If you need to get back,
this is
I understand.
Fine. You guys are nice.
All right, good.
Thank you. My name's Rich Angstrom. I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. We've been working on some amendments and worked pretty hard, the forestry folks and myself, on this issue. Whereas OCAPA has a formal position, we're not in support of the original language for a variety of reasons I'll get into. We are supportive of the dash fours and have worked with the forestry guys kind of narrowing the discussion down to where it doesn't have spillover. It's more of a knife amendment that addresses their concerns. It doesn't broaden itself out into the concrete steel side of the equation. And we felt fairly comfortable once we got there to that. And the reason is that I'm here on the concrete side is we are watching very closely that we don't create artificial preferences as we have these discussions between one construction material versus another construction material. As we have these third-party programs like LEEDS and the REACH code and Green Globes come in, there's a lot of things within them, hidden policies that you are sweeping in that are not well analyzed when we're sweeping them in, and they have effects on all of us. So the big, broad point on this is, as you know, in the construction industry, we compete for what products are used through how we make code for fire and you know, maybe thermal protection or for earthquake resistance or, you know, all kinds of things is how we generally design builds. And concrete, steel, and wood all have competed in the past in that context. With the green movement now, we have a whole new, for lack of a, you know, just from a general perspective, a whole new code that we're competing over. And that's how this, the energy efficiencies of our buildings and the carbon footprints and those kinds of things come to play. And we are, you know, we're kind of now trying to figure out how the marketplace works in that context. Okay, I think I said that somewhat staggeredly, but that's the general gist of what's going on in the market. So when LEED and Green Globes and the REACH code come in, it creates preferences within those and in the biases within those programs. And the one thing I learned, and I spent 2 weeks talking with folks back east, really trying to understand the forest industry point of view on this. And the one thing they didn't say that needs to be said is LEED, having been developed back east, has a whole different idea of how forestry works. And when you think about it, it kind of makes some sense that they're a hardwood forest, they have mixed species, and so their view of what is appropriate forestry is way different than our forestry, how we manage out here. We have a little more of a monoculture. Our climax species are Doug fir and hemlock, and you don't have this mixture. And it became pretty apparent to me, even admission from our national partners, that LEED has a anti-clear-cut kind of perspective. And we don't support that. The point is that as we sweep these third-party programs in, if they have these biases, we need to have them on the table. And so when you're making decisions to adopt statute that has LEED in it or Green Globes, that you know kind of what you're adopting. Because you're hurting, you're creating preferences, and in this case, you're hurting the forest industry. Now, the reason I'm not supportive of the original language, our association isn't supportive of the original language, because it doesn't target the issue we just discussed, where the dash fours do. And with that, I mean, I could go into a lot of detail about how we interpret the original language, but for the purposes of where we're at, is we think the Dash 4s get to what the forestry folks want to get accomplished. It's a good bill, and it starts to address this issue. The last thing I want to say is this is only the beginning of the debate. We really in this state need to define what our green movement and our green building codes are going to look like, and not have, whether it's a forestry-oriented program or an environmentally-oriented program, dictate to the state legislature what those policies and programs should look like. You guys should be making those decisions, not some third-party group that we just sweep into statute, call it LEED. I think one of the first tests is if somebody can't define LEED as leadership, energy, and environmental design, they're not an expert on it, because I'm surprised how LEED is just thrown around and nobody even knows, you know, half the people you talk to don't even know what it means. But this is a big issue, and it's going to be a big issue for our industry, and it's obviously a big issue and a real thorn in the forestry side, and we're supporting them on the intent, what they're trying to get to, just not the original language that they put forward. So with that, if I might, with the chairs up, I think the environmental community should join us on this, and here's why. We're doing a lot of great work in Oregon on energy efficiency. We're updating our equipment. I know concrete and cement plants that are putting the state-of-the-art stuff in. Same with forestry, and our forest practices are very rigorous. And the environmental community should join us in advancing the best of what Oregon does in these programs, and supporting us when we're doing the right thing, and we're modifying our equipment, we're changing our practices, and we're doing good things. And because we've adopted these standards that were developed elsewhere, it doesn't take into consideration what we're doing good in this state. And the legislature has been blind in adopting these programs. That I think this is a huge opportunity for the environmental community to step in and help us out and make it a challenge for them to define some of the best of what we do and give it some credit. So with that, I'll conclude my testimony, and thank you, Mr. Chair, for letting me preach on that last point just a little bit.
I appreciate all the input. And Representative Johnson, any other thoughts on this before we close the public hearing?
No, I think Rich summed it up well. I do think this is the beginning of a conversation, I think, that we need to have as a legislature and across the state, to come together to collectively, I think, define what sustainability means for Oregon. And let's come up with a model that works for us that accomplishes those same goals of energy efficiency, good stewards of natural resources, and so forth and so on. This is not an indictment of the goals of LEED at all. This is just simply saying we need to rein in the discussion, and let's begin to put our own fingerprints on how this actually plays out in Oregon, because, again, we're not the only state having this discussion. The green movement has moved very rapidly, and sometimes things get adopted before we have a chance to really consider their ramifications and the implications for the state. So I thank you both for this opportunity.
Co-Chair Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Representative Johnson, I'm just curious, does statute currently allow for certification under Green Globes as well as LEED?
Yes.
And does statute anywhere require LEED?
No.
Okay, thank you.
Exactly.
Just want to make sure that's clear on the record.
Any other comments or questions, committee members? If not, first I want to close that public hearing on House Bill 4166. And just quickly say, committee, we're going to try to stay within our time limit at 5 o'clock. We may have to stand down and have a short discussion or a caucus or whatever you want to call it. So hang on. We've got some moving parts here. But I do want to keep moving through the public testimony, and then we'll get to what action we may or may not be taking. With that, I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4078. And we're glad you're here. But you all have terrible handwriting, and I'm gonna call you by your first name because I don't think there's any duplicates. So I'd like to start with Glenn, Mike, and Alan. Come on up, and let's get started on the testimony for this bill. And if you'll identify and begin, I'd appreciate it. Right.
Uh, Good afternoon. My name is Michael Grenier. I am a managing partner with Smart Energy Capital. We are a solar finance and development company with offices in Portland. I am one of the principals of the firm and lead our utility scale solar development activities. I wanted to comment today on 4078 on a few specific points related to larger utility scale solar projects, projects that would be roughly 30 to 50 megawatts in size. A little background on Smart Energy. We, as a firm, last year developed over 40 megawatts of solar projects. Particularly relevant to this bill was a large utility scale project in California called Bruceville for the Sacramento Utility District. It was a roughly 22-23 megawatt DC photovoltaic power plant. And yeah, I believe you'll have pictures of that plant provided as well. We wanted to emphasize a few things about the amendment that we support. First, I'd like to emphasize our support for the raising of the cap to 250 acres. That is necessary to allow for projects of this size.
Mike, I hate to interrupt, but I just want to let you know we've got a number of people to testify, and I'm not picking on you. We're going to have to, everybody, stick to 2 minutes. Please proceed.
Yes, sir. So I want to emphasize our support for that amendment. It's critical to getting projects of this size done. Projects of this size are critical because they are the ones that can be competitive in the marketplace with other utility-scale projects from surrounding states. Second, we'd like, as proposed in the amendment, to remove the species of concern from the requirements for permitting. We felt that this went above and beyond any of the other requirements necessary for power project development and would create an enormous amount of ambiguity and uncertainty in the development process, which would, in my personal opinion, eliminate any opportunity for developing large-scale solar in Portland. I'll conclude there. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Co-Chairs Bailey and Gilliam, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak in regards to HB 4078. My name is Alan Hickenbottom. I'm a general manager of the Energy Services Group of Christensen Electric in Portland, Oregon. We're a 66-year-old Oregon-based IBEW NECA electrical contractor employing over 300 union and non-union employees in Oregon and in the West. I want to thank the Solar Resource Advisory Group for their work on this leading up to the bill. But we do have two specific concerns, much related to what Mr. Grenier talked about, which are addressed, I think, in the desk two amendments before you. The first is acreage. We would ask you to support the 250-acre size. As others have mentioned, as system costs continue to decrease, thanks in part from the support of policies such as an intelligently administered business energy tax credit, systems of this size are getting into the parity neighborhood. In other words, projects that pencil out without state tax credit support. 100 acres just isn't enough for that kind of scale, so 250 is right. Second, again, the species of concern is an issue. I think the rules as submitted are too onerous and put a significant burden on the developers. As a self-declared tree-hugging capitalist, I feel that the combination of the Endangered Species Act, state and county land use rules, and the narrow definition of the land type that can be used for this type of development provide the right level of balance protection for this sort of development. I put a bit of the language of the bill in there, but you can read that. Finally, I just wanted to give you some quick context around jobs. Specifically for us, in 2011, Christensen Electric participated in systems ranging in size from two kilowatts, a house size system, up to almost 3 megawatts. In total, we put over 100 people to work in the state on nearly 5 megawatts of solar. That produces enough clean energy to power 500 average Oregon homes. The jobs ranged in duration from 4 months to just a few days, depending on the job site, but still at over 100 people. That was a lot of folks working. And this number does not count our subcontractors or the manufacturers such as PV Powered or Solar World, nor does it count the 10 to 15 ongoing maintenance jobs, operations and maintenance jobs that would be for a system such as this. 10 to 15 doesn't sound like much, but as we all know, the multiplier factor in small rural communities is pretty big for that number of jobs. So, in closing, I want to thank the committee for their work on this bill and urge you to support the bill and with attached two amendments. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Glenn Montgomery. I'm Executive Director of Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association, the trade group that represents the solar industry in Oregon. I'm not going to repeat what these gentlemen have said. I agree with them. The Dash 2 amendments in terms of the species of concern, in terms of the acreage, those are adequate amendments. I would like to perhaps talk a little bit more about the reason why we need those amendments, not only for the economies of scale in these projects, but also in particular on the species of concern. If we were to have that added to the required level of assessment and a site-specific assessment, that will probably kill four or five projects that are currently in the queue that will take advantage of the federal investment tax credit. That tax credit expires in 2016. We need 3 to 4 years to finish these types of projects. Adding the species of concern pushes us beyond the 2016 deadline. So in effect, we lose those projects. We lose the roughly 300 jobs, the construction jobs associated with those projects. We lose the half again as many jobs related to supporting those construction jobs, and the 10 to 15 permanent jobs. So it is a significant, there's a sense of urgency here, and eliminating that using the amendment that allows us to go back to the normal requirements is something that we're very much supportive. I'm going to leave my comments at that, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you for your brevity, and thank you for your comments. Colleagues, any quick questions for this panel? If not, we're going to thank them for their testimony. And while Kent, Tim, and Joe are coming up, I'm going to ask our clerk, because I always forget to do this, not our clerk, our committee administrator, to please, Beth, give us the summary. I'll get the hang of this at some point.
That's okay. Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, you have in front of you, I believe, a Dash 1 and a Dash 2 amendment for House Bill 4078. They are not cumulative. It would be one or the other. Both address the two issues that have already been discussed today, the acreage that would trigger an FSEC review, and then also the wildlife mitigation plan that's required in the bill and whether or not species of concern would be involved in that plan.
Thank you, Beth. And remember, 2 minutes each. If you have written testimony, we're eager to receive it, and we'll make sure it's distributed. Don't read your testimony unless it's complimentary of either co-chair, and please go ahead.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is Tim Frew, business manager of the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, Local 280 in Salem, Oregon. On behalf of the over 1,100 electrical journeymen and apprentices in our local, I urge you to vote yes on House Bill 4078, and help put our members back to work. IBEW Local 280 was one of the hardest hit, if not the hardest hit, by the economic fallout in late 2008, sustaining a 50% average unemployment rate for more than a year and peaking at 65%. We have had members who have been out of work for so long that they have depleted their entire savings in order to keep food on the table for their families. We've had members have their homes foreclosed upon, and while things are beginning to turn around a bit, our unemployment rate remains at 35%, and there are things that the legislature can do to help. House Bill 4078 is a simple bill and a simple policy that will help put our highly skilled and well-trained workforce back to what they do best, working. I respectfully urge you to vote yes on House Bill 4078. Thank you, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Esmond.
Joe Esmond. Oh, for the record, Joe Esmond, a business agent, lobbyist, green old hippie for the IBW 48 in Portland, Oregon, representing over 3,000 members in Oregon and 1,000 members in Southwest Washington. 4 or 5 years ago, I sat here and endorsed some tax credits for Solar World because I was very excited that this solar thing was coming along and our members can go to work. I thought the government, the state, or federal would open up their arms and put people to work. Well, damn it, it hasn't happened. The largest solar array until about a year ago was right down the street from my office. The IBW in this state has trained 2,000 people in solar. Same people who put those in, who work on the dams, who do the intels. If I have 7 or 8 working today, 10, I'd be surprised. I did a ballpark this morning with one of my contractors, 250 acres in ideal conditions, 58 megawatts. That would comprise 290,000 solar panels. Now, I wonder what the hell Sanyo or Solar World would think about a nice little contract here in Oregon. Solar World, as you know, is getting their ass kicked by the Chinese. Anyway.
Mr. Esmond, I might remind you on language, please.
My language? I'm trying to express the will of my members.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I stand corrected. Those panels would be worth $70 million to one of the two Oregon manufacturers. We tell our members to vote for politicians. We tell them to vote for government because government is there to help you. Government is there to assist. 3, 4, 5 years of agencies and bureaucracy and vision statements and how about an endangered little rat or rock? What the hell do I tell my members? Why should we vote for politicians? Why? Because get some, please lead, okay? We need the lead. Sometimes you want to make an omelet, you got to break the eggs. Don't come back to me and tell me 18 more months of studies. I don't give a damn, okay? And my members don't either. They want to go to work. If it wasn't for Intel, I'd be just like Mr. Frew's crew here. Thank you very much for your patience with me. I've been up all night thinking about this. Any questions? You probably don't, but I would take them.
Thank you. Mr. Madsen.
Co-Chair Bailey and Co-Chair Gilman and members of the committee, I'm Kent Madison. I'm a third-generation farmer out of the Hermiston area, a landowner and a solar developer and also a wind farmer, so I consider myself a natural resource manager, basically. I support the amendments to House Bill 4078. My question is why am I entitled in Oregon to go plant 1,000 acres of corn or 500 acres of wheat or 1,500 acres of peas or beans or potatoes or anything like that, and the government doesn't tell me how many acres of those things I can plant. The market tells me that. But yet if I want to go plant solar panels to convert solar energy from food to electrons to power the energy of this Capitol building, I'm told at how many acres I can do that development on and the class of ground that I can put that on. Yet we build the Capitol, our state's capital, on the most highest valued land in the world and the highest productive land in the world, but yet you're telling me that I can't put solar panels on any ground that I choose on my farm and harvest the energy in electrons instead of corn or peas or beans. So I support these amendments, but I do believe that the 250-acre limit should just be eliminated. We should be able to build these things as large as we need to on the ground that we own, on the areas that we choose to produce it on. If I'm going to put solar panels on a poor piece of ground, I'm doing it because it's the economic thing to do, not because the government told me to do it or the government told me I can't do it. Let's let the economic system drive this and not let politics drive it. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Next up, John, Brian, and Marion, please come forward, and we will welcome your comments.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is John Mullis. I represent the Oregon State Building and Construction Trades Council. You already heard the first panel speak in depth to the technicalities of the bill. I would like to agree with what Mr. Montgomery said. We have great concerns about adding species of concern. We think that is going to send a terrible message not only for this session of the industry, but for job development and growth as a whole. And we also have great concerns about the timing of these projects and being able to get them out the door in a timely fashion. You've heard from the second panel, some of my colleagues, about the state of our industry and the unemployment and the suffering that's out there. And I would just like to state again that, you know, people pick up the paper and they say the unemployment rate ticked down 0.2%, or you had 10,000 less first week job claims these aren't statistics. They're real people with real families and real bills to pay. We have members that are living with their spouses and their kids in their parents' garages. I cannot overemphasize how dire the situation is for these people. This is only my second session this biennium. It's the first day I haven't had my jobs pin on. I actually had it on earlier and gave it away to Congresswoman Darlene Hooley earlier in the hall, and I'll get another one out tomorrow and have it back on. But everybody agrees that jobs are number one. This just seems like a very common sense compromise that I urge you respectfully to vote for so we can put some of our members back to work. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gilliam, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brian Krieg. Today I'm representing the Oregon State Association of Electrical Workers. We are also in support of the bill and the amendments and agree with many of the things that have been said before. What I'd just like to focus on for a moment here is the bigger economic development marketing perspective. We have great concerns about what the message is if we do not move ahead with this type of problem, project. Oregon's current policy in regards to solar farms at best is giving a mixed signal about our state's commitment to clean energy, sustainability, and the ability to site almost any type of new business in the state. If we cannot put even this clean renewable energy facility out in the middle of minimally populated areas on land with minimal agricultural productivity, then what are the chances of bringing in other businesses into other areas of the state? The issues that are being put in front of us as roadblocks on here could be extrapolated to anywhere in the state. At the same time, we're trying to market Oregon as a leader in clean renewable energy, technology, and sustainability, and we're blocking the pathway to one of the best energy options we have. Energy generation option that has significantly fewer environmental downsides to it than most any other option. We encourage you to move ahead with this bill, put Oregonians back to work, and secure Oregon's image as a vibrant place to bring new businesses to, especially ones about energy technology.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Gilliam and Bailey, committee members. My name is Marion Haynes. I represent Portland General Electric. We serve over 820,000 customers in 52 cities, largely in the northern Willamette Valley. I agree with much has been said around the issues raised with species of concern in the acreage. I want to just raise a little bit different issue, a little bit more 30,000-foot level. We have our energy demands that are continuing to grow from our customers. At the same time, a lot of the traditional sources of energy production has been limited. We have an emissions portfolio that says we can no longer make investments in coal plants in the state except on a short-term basis. We've agreed to close the Boardman facility by 2020. The state, on the other hand, has also enacted a renewable portfolio standard and a solar capacity standard that mandates that utilities meet certain requirements for renewable energy and solar energy. And things like this just put up hurdles in the way of our ability to do that. I think that this committee could serve a great role in helping to align some of those policies and rules across the state so that the laws that you've enacted that we are required to comply with don't face unnecessary hurdles and ultimately additional costs for our customers. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for this panel? Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, colleagues, it looks like we've got, we finally got an energy committee in the House, which I'm very happy about. We have got what appears to be quite the workforce ready to go, ready to work. And I think that, of course, we can't do it in February, but we got to take a page out of Scotland's book and set our RPS at 80% renewable, because I bet you we could do it. It's just a comment. We've got solar, we've got tidal, we've got wave, we've got geothermal, we've got wind, we've got all these things. Oregon could be, I mean, probably 100% renewable. We've got all these people willing to go to work. We've got people who want, the farmer has land to put these things on. It's just, I would really like to have us do this type of project for one sector. Thank you.
Thank you for that comment.
Are there other comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just very concerned that we're becoming the state of just say no. And
we are suffering unemployment. We have record levels of poverty. We have record levels of food insecurity in this state. And we have the opportunity to develop clean, renewable energy. And I am very concerned that we are about to toss the baby out with the bathwater here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. We have got one more person to testify. We want to thank you for your testimony. And that person is Alec.
Co-Chair Bailey and Gilliam and members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify here today. Rather than repeat too much of what has been said already, I am here as a representative of Oregon Electric Group. I'm project manager there. Oregon Electric Group is a large electrical contractor based in Portland. We employ about 850 people, including around 750 IBEW electricians. With the support that the state has shown in numerous ways for solar, I do believe that restricting these utility-scale solar sites to 100 acres and requiring wildlife studies that are not required of other forms of development does present a unnecessary restriction on the ability to actually install these projects within the state of Oregon rather than just build the modules here. We firmly support the bill and with the amendments to do away with those restrictions. Thank you for the opportunity, and I'll take any questions if you have.
Thank you very much.
Sorry.
Just to go, Chair. Should we just get this on like a lazy Susan?
Thank you for your testimony. I appreciate it. Colleagues, we're going to come back. No, wait. Vice Chair Boone.
I forgot to add hydro. I would like to see hydro become renewable. Thank you very much.
Well, no controversy there. Colleagues, I'm going to close this public hearing, but we're going to have another chance to make a comment about this bill, so just hang with us. I want to thank everyone who came and bothered to testify again on this bill, and we will have a little more to say about it in a moment. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 4078. And I'd like to open a public hearing on House Bill 4101. And again, we're inviting the testimony of those in the room that signed up. So start with Kent, Tyson, and John. And as they come up, Beth, our able administrator, will, in the right order now, give us the summary.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 4101 addresses use of water from the Columbia River. I'm going to speak very briefly about the Dash 1 amendment, which you should have in your packet. First of all, the amendment would modify some of the whereas statements in the bill, in the original bill, and replaces the remainder of that bill. It directs the Water Resources Department to aggressively pursue development of new water supplies for both consumptive and in-stream uses by using storage, conservation, and reuse of Columbia River water, including increasing the amount of water available to agricultural appropriation by a minimum of 100,000 acre feet above 2011 levels. There is a fiscal life statement on that amendment and no revenue impact.
Thank you, Beth. Thank you for accommodating our colleague, and I meant to start with you, Representative Klain, and we appreciate the work you've done on this and that you're here today. Please enlighten us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members of the committee. I'm requesting today.
Go ahead and identify.
Thank you. My name is Mike McLean. I'm state representative for House District 55. I'm the chief sponsor of 4101. And I've also, and I'll explain later, the collaborative effort to produce the Dash 1 amendments, which I'm, and I do request this committee to adopt the Dash 1 amendment and send this to Ways and Means or Rules, because we have more work to do. And in that regard, I know that to try to do something on a water bill was a tall order in a short session. And for that matter, I may be the poster child of the phrase rookie move, but my goal of bringing this bill was I wanted to do something that would bring a balanced approach to try to get jobs going. And frankly, you know, I sit not on any policy committee. I was one of the only freshmen who had no policy committees on Ways and Means. And I sat last session, and I've heard over and over the difficult plight we are having making budget, and the very discouraging information that we have the highest food insecurity of children per capita in the nation. And after hearing statistic after statistic, and knowing that we have opportunities to do something, you know, my conclusion of moving forward was to say, if there's anything that can be done, let's try to do it. And if we can't do it, then at least we can look at ourselves and go home and look at our constituents and said we did everything we could to try to produce an environment for more jobs in Oregon, because all statistics show that the reason we have that deplorable distinction of having the highest food insecurity amongst children is because we have high unemployment and high underemployment amongst parents. And everybody wants to see more jobs. And so I very quickly put together a bill that would, my intent was that it would use storage as a means for supplying water for fish and for farms. That there is an admirable program in the state of Washington that started in 2006. And through their efforts of using storage and in innovative techniques to be able to have high river flows or winter flows being stored to release during the summer to use for irrigation, for municipal, for industrial, that they produced roughly about 80,000 acre feet so far and new water rights for the state of Washington. And Oregon has been doing and making an effort to restore aquifers, and nothing in the Dash 1 amendments would interfere with that. In fact, nothing about this bill and nothing about the amendment would negate existing water rights or environmental protections. The goal is simply put to say, can we engage like Washington engaged? And it takes multiple steps. And this, you know, the Dash 1 is to make it clear that we're talking about the excess flows or the winter flows so that we can use them during the drier months. And so the hope is that we could do something that's very difficult, and I realize that the ask that I've made of you and the ask that I've made of other people was pretty high. And I and to a certain extent, you know, I wish we had more time. But while we're here, and if we can get this amended into another committee, we could give another week or 10 days to try to work to a collaborative language that would move Oregon down the road to join Washington and some innovative storage projects, including subsequent alternatives that perhaps we could even participate with the state of Washington and their storage projects. More discussion and collaboration is needed, and I'm grateful for it to a lot of people, and I won't name them all, but a lot of people have given me their time and tried to make this better, and that's really the goal, is can we make it better, and can we come up with a clear statement that Oregon is going to participate in storage as a way to meet the need for further production agriculture so we can have more jobs and help meet the need. That the Dash 1 amendment targets a minimum of 100,000 acre feet. There could be more. In fact, I believe some of the big storage ideas that the state of Washington and others have talked about could produce more. Steve Shropshire is here, and he can actually talk about better detail what Washington has done. But at any event, the I know I've heard I've had council of senior members have told me, look, it's not where you start, but it's where you end up together that's critical. And so my goal is to is that you would accept or adopt the Dash Ones, which I think have go a long way to clarifying this bill is about storage of winter flows and with a goal of 100,000 acre feet for agriculture by 2018. And it's the first step. And we're going to have to tackle more steps, and including funding in future sessions. But again, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and for all the members of the committee who have spent time with me to try to improve the language into that. I appreciate it. Thank
you, Representative. And I know you put a lot of work on this, and you've probably learned a great deal about the situation. There's somebody that wants to talk to me.
Mr. Co-Chair, may I ask, make a statement?
Please go right ahead.
Councilor Tucker, thank you. Representative McLean, you opened your testimony by talking about perhaps a rookie move. I think every person on this committee has been in a position where we have bitten off things that then later turned out to be very large in the chewing. And it is generally only through getting fresh blood into the process and to bring new eyes to extremely complicated problems that sometimes we can bridge historical divides. And you have jumped into this with both feet into very turbulent waters, and I think have impressed a lot of people, certainly impressed me, with your willingness to listen and consider all sides. I know that your efforts are still a work in progress on this, and no matter how this turns out or no matter where the vote is, I want to thank you for your efforts on this, and I think you've shown statesmanship.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that.
Well said, Mr. Co-Chair. And colleagues, we are, the co-chairs are intending to focus on the Dash Ones, which we are having distributed. So just to be sure, I'll understand that you'll have them shortly. And if nobody has any quick questions for the representative, Representative Witt?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick one that's very important to my district. I want to thank Representative McLean for his very good and great efforts at trying to create economic development for our state. For the record, Representative, could you tell us what the intention is for water drawdowns with respect to what time of year they would occur under your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Witt, the drawdown would be during the high flow years. I think the technical term is the excess flows. Most people think of them about winter flows, but the water would be, in essence, diverted during the high winter flows into storage, both above ground and below. Now the specifics, we're starting the process, but it is not the intent to draw during summer months. In fact, it's the intent to be able to release it during the summer months for the benefit of agriculture, and certainly if we need to, for the benefit of fish, to comply with our current environmental regulations.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. We're going to move on. Now, we're getting more under the time crunch. So again, everyone, I need you to have concise. We're glad you're here, but have a concise testimony. Don't repeat what somebody else has said. Don't read your testimony. We were eager to read your written testimony, and please proceed.
Okay. Co-Chair Bailey, Co-Chair Gillum, my members of the committee, for the record, my name is Tyson Raymond. I'm the president of the Oregon Wheat Growers League, statewide organization representing farmers across the state, and I'm also a farmer in northeastern Oregon. my purpose here today is to perhaps provide you a little bit of perspective on what exactly water does for agriculture. I represent wheat growers but I feel obligated to represent agriculture as a whole in this instance.
As an example, I farm approximately about 6,000 acres in the northeastern Oregon, southeastern Washington. 5,000 of that is 12-inch rainfall, and I grow 70 bushel wheat every other year on that. I have to summer follow it. 30 miles north of that in southeastern Washington, where I farm about 1,000 acres, I get 4 more inches of rain, and I continually plant and harvest 80 bushels to the acre every year. So, and that's on 4 inches of rain. So when we're talking about 100,000 acre feet, the economic impact of that amount of water is significant, to say the least. For exactly what 100,000 acre feet of water would do is it would increase the value of approximately 30,000 acres of land. This land, I don't, if people have been around Hermiston, it's not high-value land. It's probably non-irrigated, between 100 and 200 acres, or $100 and $200 to the acre. You put water on that, there'd be 30,000 acres that would increase northward of $4,000 to the acre, which represents a 20-30-fold increase in the value of that asset the accompanying tax revenue generated from it. So the area that's affected by this, 30 miles from the I-84, I-82 interchange, a 30-mile radius right there is in excess of a $1 billion economic engine that is solely based on the usage of water. Without water, that would not exist. And we compliment Representative McLean's efforts here. 100,000 acre feet of water would do a lot of families a lot of good.
Thank you for your testimony. When I put this up here, it means you got 30 seconds to go. Please
proceed.
I didn't
see it.
No. This is your exempt.
I'm warned. You are.
Co-Chair Bailey and Co-Chair Gill and representatives, I'm Kent Madison of Madison Farms. I'm an irrigated farmer out of the Columbia River system, located out of Hermiston, Oregon. I applaud the effort of bringing this, the issue of Columbia River water back up. I applaud the effort of trying to re-raise this. I actually own the last Columbia River water right that was issued out of the state of Oregon in 1989 for agricultural production. And the problem that I see with this bill is it still does not create new water. I am a owner and manager of the first artificial storage and recovery system in the world for agricultural purposes, and is incredibly expensive. I mean, literally hundreds and hundreds of dollars per acre, to where a normal, sane person would not have done it. But I got into it, and I'm a little on the crazy side. But anyway, I applaud this effort. If the state is going to go out and build a storage facility to mitigate for summertime water withdrawals, and us as irrigators can then go to the state and tap into that system, this bill would probably work. We have been trying for 22 years now to mitigate for summertime withdrawals, and as a private individual, you cannot afford to do that. You cannot afford to do storage and recovery systems for large-scale agricultural production. But if this bill is going to offer the state to do that, and then we can access a facility that then has this water in it, that's a different story. The question I have on that is, why? Why are we spending our resources as a society to store water in a river system that is probably the most plentiful river system in the world today, and we're going to store that water in the wintertime to use in the summertime, when Oregon currently uses 0.3% of that river's flow? 0.3% is the next time you stick your spoon into your coffee cup and pull it out, that's 0.3% of what's stuck to your spoon. I ask the state is, if the salmon or the fisheries industry or the for-profit environmental groups that you've heard one of the chairman's comment about, if they can't allow those fish to survive and the rest of that cup full of water and all we took out was what was stuck to that spoon, then the fish are probably going to die anyway. But yet when I drive down the gorge and I see gillnet after gillnet after gillnet catching fish, and it, sure, they're worth $20 or $30 per fish on the market, and I hear the state say, we need to develop jobs, we need to develop economic base, we need you farmers to help stimulate the economy, I really ask, do you really want us to? I mean, when we take 0.3% and we could generate literally billions of dollars of economic value, if we could get that water directly in the summertime, during summertime flows without having, I can't say we wouldn't harm fish, but the latest study that was done in the late 80s, early 90s, showed that a diversion of about this 100,000 acre foot size would harm 6/10 of one fish. So the question becomes, state, public, representatives, do we want to develop economics and harm another 6/10 of one fish, or do we want to just go buy a salmon tag from somebody and say, just don't go catch one, and we'll go develop economics?
John, we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you for your testimony. Peggy, Steve, and Tom. Oh, Kent, I'm sorry. I meant to say your name. Kent's done. Now, John, Peggy, and Steve. So sorry. Two minutes each, and I'll show you when you've got 30 seconds left.
Thank you, Chair Gilliam and Chair Bailey, members of the committee. My name is John DeVoe. I'm the executive director of Water Watch of Oregon. I've been in this chair before many times on Columbia River water, and I appreciate working with Representative McLean on these issues as we've gotten to this point. Water Watch would like to point out that if we are really talking about winter water, there is no need for a bill. Winter water is available from the Columbia. The only thing that prevents its use and its development and its storage are rational economics and the current processes that we go through for storage. Winter water is available in many months of the year on the Columbia. So I want to, if we are truly talking about winter water, I want to make that clear that we don't need a bill. This bill, the Dash 1 amendments, would allow the use of summertime water from the Columbia, and that would be contrary to existing state policy in many areas. And I think that's important. You know, Mr. Madison brought up some issues about 0.3%. We've discussed this before in this chamber, where if you discuss the annual volumetric discharge of the Columbia River, that tells you absolutely nothing about what's happening at any specific time of year on a real-time basis for fish as they move through the various pools behind the dams on the Columbia. If, when we were talking about 450,000 acre feet under the first version of this bill, you get to percentages of 20-25% of the John Day pool of the river in a dry year like we had in 2001. So I think the 0.3% number is quite a red herring, and we shouldn't focus on it. We're willing to work to come up with a solution here. Things we could agree to include winter water. But the bill would have to be expanded to include restoration of in-stream flows. It would have to include storage consistent with existing state policy.
Don, you're going to have to wrap it up.
Which is multi-purpose storage, and that storage should be off-channel storage to make it work. So I appreciate your time and your consideration of our written testimony. Happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. Peggy.
Peggy Lynch, League of Women Voters of Oregon. As written, the League is opposed to the bill. We have a very strong position regarding the Columbia River Basin and have been active on this issue since 1979, where we worked with the Leagues of Washington, Montana, and Idaho to help develop policies around our shared river. We believe in comprehensive planning on a basin-wide basis for conservation, development, and management of the water. We believe that there needs to be an inventory or data source behind any decisions related to the water. And we believe that a minimum stream flow should be established as a public right and maintained on all streams in the Columbia River Basin. Specifically on this bill, with the short length of time I have, is although the task force idea appeals to the League, we are concerned about the cost of this project at this time and the makeup and rules governing the task force. As I mentioned, an inventory or data collection should be the basis for any task force work. The Columbia River is a significant and irreplaceable public resource, and monies available to the Water Resources Department should go towards completing the first integrated water resources strategy to be adopted later this year. Currently, there's not enough money to adequately engage the general public on that important decision. And I have not seen the fiscal on this particular bill, but I'm assuming that not only Water Resources, but other agencies would have to be a part of this. And simply, the realities of the budget this session means that perhaps this is not timely. Thank you.
Thank you, Peggy, for being brief, and I appreciate your comments. Please, go ahead, Steve.
Afternoon, Co-Chairs Bailey, Gilliam, members of the committee. My name is Steve Shropshire. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon Association of Nurseries. The Oregon Association of Nurseries represents the state's largest agricultural sector, and the nursery industry is an industry that is based on the use of water. It is within the Columbia Basin, and I'll remind the committee that this bill's relating clause relates to water use within the Columbia Basin. That is most of our state. It is not just the Columbia River. Therefore, this bill has an impact that goes well beyond what we would think of as the Columbia River by itself. Nonetheless, and very much because of that, the Oregon Association of Nurseries takes a keen interest in this bill. Our state is in the midst of a water crisis, whether those of us here in the western, wetter side of the state would acknowledge that or not. In the summertime, there is not enough water to sustain the water rights that have been granted, both for agriculture or for natural flows for fish and ecological systems. The Nursery Association members are good stewards of the environment. Many of them have been on their lands for years and years, and they strongly believe that there is a pathway where both agricultural development and the economic development flows from irrigated agriculture and the natural environment can coexist. What this bill does, the Dash One amendments, is sets a priority where the state of Oregon thinks very strongly about prioritizing the enhancement of flows for the use of our state, both for irrigated agriculture, but also for the species as they face increasing needs in the future. The Integrated Water Resources Strategy that has been mentioned identifies climate change, over-appropriation, and other factors as increasing demand on a limited supply. It is very much a need that has been identified in that strategy as the development and enhancement of additional water supplies, and the Oregon Association of Nurseries is a strong supporter of that approach. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you for your testimony. Thank all three of you. We're going to move on, and I'd like to ask Tom Wolf, Teresa Hunsinger, and I don't know if Paul Cosgrove or Katie Fast prefers. If they come together, they each get 45 seconds.
I'm here for Paul.
Okay, fine. Tom, why don't you go and identify and begin.
Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, committee members, my name is Tom Wolf with Trout Unlimited. I am not going to spend a lot of time. Unfortunately, I didn't get any prepared comments in because I've worked on about three other prepared comments for today. I'm just going to echo a lot of the things that John DeVoe with Water Watch said. Trout Unlimited, one of our main goals in the Northwest is restoration and recovery of the Columbia River salmon runs, and we're concerned about any bill that could have an impact on the water. We appreciate the work that Representative McLean does, and we certainly would not be opposed to using winter flows, and we certainly want to see the farming community in Oregon be able to use more water, but we say that this bill should be deferred, and Representative McLean, whoever else, should come back next session when there's more time and work on a bill that brings together all parties and work for a common solution that we could all support and agree upon. Thank you.
Tom, thank you for disagreeing and not being disagreeable. I appreciate you being here. Teresa Hunsinger, please.
Good afternoon, Co-Chairs Bailey and Gilliam and members of the committee. Thanks for the opportunity to be here this afternoon. My name is Teresa Hunsinger, and I'm with the Oregon Environmental Council. I'm our program director for Clean and Plentiful Water. And we appreciate that the Dash One amendments have significantly improved the bill by including water conservation, but we are still opposed to the bill, including the Dash One amendments. And as several people have said already today, really the key issue with water from the Columbia is about when you take the water out. And while I've heard assurance that the bill is designed to be only about winter water, when I read the bill, it appears that it's still looking to take more water from the Columbia during the spring and summer months, especially when you look at Section 2-2, which directs the department to consider new mitigation options, which you would really only need to do if you were talking about summer water. And just to take a step back, the reason why this timing is important is
Teresa,
essentially...
Teresa, I'm not disagreeing with you, but I want to make sure you're referring to the Dash Ones as well.
correct? Yes, I'm referring to the dash ones.
Please continue.
Yes. So to take a step back, the reason why this is important is because one of the major factors in mortality for salmon is their ability for the juveniles to move downstream. They're adapted to a river that used to flow quickly. Now with the dams, it's basically a series of lakes. So these minimum target flows were established in order to help those fish be able to move downstream. So there's really not an ability to take more water out in the summer. So if this bill were just about winter storage of water, as others have said, you wouldn't need legislation because it's something you can do already. I also wanted to point out that there are great opportunities to find new water resources through water conservation. And if you take a look in my testimony, there's a little chart here about use of the state's allocation of conserved water program. It's just now beginning to take off. And as of today, through that program, there is now new water that's being applied to about 4,500 acres of land through water conservation. So I want to make sure that that is part of our perspectives as we're thinking about ways to find new water in the state. It's a program that's already existing. It's working. The only limitation is that most irrigators still don't know about it yet. So a small investment in outreach at the Water Resources Department could really help launch that program. I would also like to take us back to the Integrated Water Resources Strategy and the basin planning process that is a part of that. There could be an opportunity for identifying water supplies in the Columbia Basin to be basically the first basin in that local planning process as opposed to starting something new through another form of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. We may not agree on this bill, but I never want to dissuade anyone from a conservation plug, so thank you for that. It's very important. Katie Fast.
Good afternoon. For the record, Katie Fast. Today I'm not only testifying on behalf of Oregon Farm Bureau, but also for the Oregon Committee. The Oregon Committee is a coalition of business interests that represent businesses across Oregon, both rural and urban interests. Oregon's natural resource industries are the backbone of Oregon's economy. Agriculture is our second highest traded sector in the state, and 1 in 12 jobs is tied to agriculture, with 80% of our products being exported and 50% of those going internationally. Those jobs are both rural and urban. And water is the lifeblood of Oregon agriculture. The lack of water in the Umatilla Basin and in other areas of the state is our main limiting factor on growth. The declining aquifer levels in the Umatilla have created a situation where farmers have been regulated off their water rights. Additionally, there are other acreage in the Umatilla Basin that's open for irrigation. It could be growing, as you heard, higher productive crops that create both on-farm jobs, processing jobs, and traded sector jobs. 4101 is not the fix-all for the problems in the basin. It's a step forward in addressing their issues. It takes a small piece of the issue, looking at storage water and also some new mitigation options. But it doesn't, it's a scaled back version than what we've seen in the past in this building. This legislation is a step in the right direction and brings us forward for continuing the dialogue in future sessions. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Katie. A quick comment from my vice chair.
Tom, your total objective is you want to protect what's there and enhance salmon, and we do that with water. Is that correct?
Co-chair Gilliam, co-vice chair Krieger, that's correct.
Just a comment on that. We met Monday with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service regarding cormorants. They're taking 50% of the fish, both wild and native and hatchery, in the Columbia River system. That's not counting terns. That's not counting mergansers. 24 states are now managing cormorants. Oregon's working towards that. And I'd like to have you come on board and maybe come by my office, and we'll discuss the fact that we think we can get a 30% increase in the smolts released from the existing fish we've got now and actually get them to the ocean. And that can be done in 2 years. So I think we're on our way.
Co-chair Gilliam, vice co-chair Krieger, as I've expressed to Bob Olson and many others, I'd love to be on board on that, dealing with the cormorants. I think it's a serious problem, and I'd love to help in any way I can.
Thank you.
would like to thank this panel and say that we have four more testifiers. So would Jan Meekums, John Mullis, and would Joe come back up? Is he still in the room? While we're rounding up Joe, Bill, if Bill's here, still Bill Cluding, come on up and go right ahead, John.
Thank you, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey. My name is John Mullis. I represent the Oregon State Building and Trades Council. I'm here to testify in favor of the bill with the Dash 1 amendments. I am not going to speak to the technicalities of the bill. I am equally credentialed as a hydrologist and as a brain surgeon, so I'm going to skip drilling down deep.
Thank you very much.
I'm just here to testify in favor of creation of the task force to look at the issues that people before have testified to. If you look at the water flows of the Columbia River over the last 2 to 4 weeks, all of which is out in the ocean now, I just can't imagine that you couldn't get a bunch of smart people in a room that were willing to compromise a little bit and figure out a way to store that water, create some jobs building the water storage facilities, create some more jobs in the agriculture industry, which probably a lot of it's going to get exported, which is going to create more jobs on the river system and for the longshoremen. So you heard my earlier remarks about the status of our industry. I won't repeat them again. But I just hope that people, again, would come together, would compromise, and move something forward that could possibly help put people back to work. Thank you.
Thank you, John. And we will try to get some smart people in the room and members of the committee, too. Jan, go right ahead.
Thank you very much, Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, and members of the committee. My name is Jan Meekums. I'm the State Director for NFIB, National Federation of Independent Business. We represent about 7,000 members, over 7,000 members in the state of Oregon, about 350,000 members in the country. And we last fall, we did a survey. And 52% of our members reported that their number one concern is that they do not have customers that can either afford their business or have the economic ability to take advantage of what they have to offer. And today we just published our optimum index from January, and it said that there's a net percent, it reported that there's a net percent that owners are expecting conditions in the next 6 months would be a negative 3%, and that's 13 percent points below the same question of a year ago. And it's well known that I'm not speaking either to the technical aspects of the bill, just to the fact that Oregon needs jobs, and jobs equals customers. And our small businesses desperately need customers. Our sales reps that are out in the field report to me on a regular basis the heartbreaking stories that all of us have heard in this building and that you have heard back in your district, that people are unemployed, underemployed. And I am here to support this bill and any other bill in this building that results in jobs. I know this is a task force. I know it's complicated. I know it's going to take time. But I think we need to exert every bit of intention that we can to move this bill forward, not to let it get quagmired, and so it actually can result in jobs for our Oregonians. And with that, NFIB supports this bill and your efforts and Representative McLean's efforts to bring this to the forefront and keep it moving. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jan. Thank you for your voice for all of our independent businesses. I appreciate it. John.
Thank you, Representative Co-Chair Gilliam, Co-Chair Bailey, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Carpenters. You have in your hands right here thousands of jobs. I've been showing this around. But literally, there's thousands of jobs. As you look down through those points, Oregon needs help. And this is a help. You've heard testimony through the previous sessions about the withdrawal of that water. I hear this level. I hear this level. I say we need to really look at this and get this bill moving. The transportation is there. The infrastructure is there. The barren acres are there. Look at the things that's happened just recent. We've signed trade agreements now. We could export a lot more to these countries that we have free trade with. Look at the vegetables we could grow on that land. We could bring fresh vegetables into Portland, into any city in this state, into our schools. Good vegetables, clean vegetables. You don't have to worry about what come across the border. In addition, we got all the windmills. We got excess power. In fact, we got excess power to the point Bonneville shut them down. Bonneville found out they can't shut them down. They had to spill water over the dams. That puts nitrogen into the water, which can kill our little fish going out, our big fish coming back. This helped protect these fish species. This create the thousands of jobs. Did I mention this is thousands of jobs? Let's get Oregon's economy going. I heard a statement a minute ago that said, at this time, Oregon can't afford this. I say, Oregon cannot afford not to do this. Thank you.
Bill, you preach a mean sermon. Thank you for those comments. I appreciate it very much. Colleagues, we have one more person on this bill, so I would like for Mike Sullivan to come on up. Mike's good. Colleagues, I'm going to close the public hearing, and then we're going to have a short recess. I'll close the public hearing on this bill, which is House Bill 4101, and the committee is in short recess.
for sticking with us. We're going to get through this next chapter here in less than 10 minutes, and I hope you'll just hang here with me. We have some votes coming up. First of all, I would like to open the work session, a work session, on the bill we just discussed, House Bill 4101. So that work session is open. We did not have time for questions, and colleagues, I want to get to Representative Witt, but are there comments about this bill and the testimony that you heard before I go to Representative Witt? Others?
Just one thing. Will this satisfy Mr. Schaffer, Representative Schaffer, you think?
What would?
That's a question for the ages.
Any other comments? Representative Witt, I know you wanted to speak to this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is a bill that I want very badly, and I want this economic development not only for Representative McLean's district, but for the whole state of Oregon. With that said, testimony today from the environmental community has convinced me that this bill, even with the Dash 1 amendment, is lacking one critical phrase, and I think that it needs to contain the phrase that the drawdown will be limited to the winter freshet. With that, I would like to reserve further comment until the any of the amendments possibly are adopted.
Fair enough, and I appreciate that very much. I know those are sincere comments, Representative. And Mr. Co-Chair, comment?
Pardon me.
So Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the time at which I would say something and not when we vote. Is that correct?
You can say it now or you can say it later. So it's your choice. There will be a time for discussion on the bill should the amendment pass and we go to that point.
So then I'll wait.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 4101.
Co-Chair Bailey moves to adopt the Dash 1 amendment dated February the 14th, 2012. Any discussion on the amendment? Is there any objection to the amendment? Seeing none, the amendment is adopted. I would entertain another motion, Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. But prior to making the motion, I want to make a comment.
Please.
If I may, a wise co-chair in another committee, whose name might rhyme with Jick Villiam, showed me the path on allowing a committee to vote on a bill when there was a will to do so on that, regardless of his personal feelings, and I admire that. In that same vein, I'm going to make a motion here without guaranteeing a vote on it. I respect the work that has been done to date on this bill. I respect that sides have come together. I'm not sure that we are there yet, but the conversation may continue. I know that lots of parties are going to continue to work on this, and I would reiterate that I'm appreciative of Representative McLean's efforts to find a solution here. So with that,
thank you, Mr. Coach.
We have a couple of complex motions to make on this bill. Co-Chair Gilliam, I move to rescind the referral of House Bill 4101 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Committee on Ways and Means and refer House Bill 4101 as amended without recommendation to the House Committee on Rules.
Co-Chair Bailey moves to rescind the referral of House Bill 4101 as amended by the Dash 1 amendment to the Committee on Ways and Means and refer House Bill 4101 as amended without recommendation to the House Committee on Rules. This is necessary, and is there any discussion? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be a yes on this referral to rules because I think this is a critically important bill, but I would also hope that in rules the bill be further amended to limit the drawdown to winter flows exclusively. Should this bill make it to the floor absent that kind of amendment, I want to make it very clear that I have given my word to my constituents that I will never do anything that in my own mind would in any way threaten or imperil the ecosystem, and absent that language, I believe that this bill would, and I may would likely be a no on the House floor.
Duly noted, Representative, and I appreciate your commitment to this issue and to the bill, and I appreciate your reservation, as you have stated them on the record, and it will be noted, and we understand. Thank you very much for that. Any other discussion? Vice Chair Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I would like to add that with further work on this bill in Rules Committee, which would include, which I think is the intent of the bill, is to only limit to the withdrawals to the winter months and winter high flow months to be used in the summer months when they're needed for agriculture. And I also applaud Representative McLean's work on this, and I know that he's very sincere in getting to yes, as Representative Witten, my senator, would say. And I think it can be done in discussions with different people who represent all kinds of interests. I think that we can get there, and I think that this can be a win-win for all. And I would love to continue working on this, and it's time. There, you know, it's not over yet, and I think we can get this done.
And you know this doesn't involve the ocean.
It kind of does, but that's another story.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you.
We're going down the line here. Representative Kenny Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I will be voting no on this, but with some of the same enthusiasm and reservations that have been expressed already. I want to also applaud you, Representative McLean, for the incredible work you've done and the intent of your bill and your attempt to draw the different stakeholders together. I'm concerned about the short timetable and how many things we're referring to rules. I want this to be something, because it's going to be a very long-term effort and will affect the ecosystem, that something that really all parties can get behind. There were some other testimony here that was submitted from some American Rivers, Columbia Riverkeeper, as well as Pacific Coast Federation of Fishermen's Associations that were in opposition. So it's a significant number of concerns that have been put on the table. So I kind of come at it from the opposite point of view, which is I want to register a no vote because I want it when it comes out of this committee to see that there are, you know, people look at the votes to see that there was real concern about this. On the other hand, if people are able to come together and really come to agreement in this very short amount of time, I reserve the right to end up voting the opposite way. So a little bit of the opposite side of what some of my colleagues have expressed.
Thank you for that clarification on your position. Are there other comments? I will allow it, Representative Bentz, but please do not compliment Representative McLean. I am tired of it.
Didn't plan on it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, just a couple of things. For 25 years almost, I've worked on water-related issues, and it would take someone like Representative McLean to be brave enough to bring a bill like this.
I'm sorry.
but I do think there's an opportunity. I've noticed suffer in this building and in many other places in Oregon from what I would call, and everyone's heard of, the theory of misplaced concreteness. And that means that the many aspects of our water law are taken as pretty precise when in point of fact they are not. And when it comes to winter flows, that's a interesting term and imprecise, but we all know what we're saying. What we're really saying is when there's water available, that won't hurt somebody else's interest. And it seems to me that there's opportunity if we think it through and draw everybody into the room and have meeting after meeting, and eventually we'll get something done. And this is not without a great deal of frustration that I say this, because for 25 years we've been having those meetings. And I'm a lot older now, and we still don't seem to be taking much water out of the Columbia. We're making a little progress, but given the layer upon layer upon layer upon layer of complexity that goes with the Columbia system, it's no surprise. I think a lot of people in here, myself included, sometimes think that we're master of our own fate when it comes to the Columbia. We are not. There are many other folks that have lots to say about what's going to happen to that water. And so this is a first step, a necessary one, and I look forward to working further on this. I'll be voting for the motion.
Thank you, Representative Bentz. If there are no other comments or discussion on this motion, I am going to ask our able clerk to call the roll, please.
Representative Vint.
Aye.
No. Representative Thompson.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Bailey.
No.
Co-Chair Gilliam.
Aye. And before I put the gavel down, I'm wondering if Representative McLean can finish this cliche. Whiskey is for?
Drinking.
Motion passes.
Beer for my horses.
We will now open. We will close the work session on House Bill 4101, and I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 4166.
Representative, co-chair, I would entertain another motion.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4166 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Co-Chair Bailey moves Senate Bill 4166 to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this motion? Mr. Co-Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I appreciate the issue that Representative Johnson has brought before us. It is an issue that we have discussed extensively in the Committee on Tax Credits and that was before us as we crafted House Bill 3672 in last session. And it's part of the reason that we had on the record that the tax credit is structured such that it is that Green Globes and LEED are treated and other standards are treated equally within that tax credit structure. So I want to make sure that that is clear. Our interest here in moving the base bill is that it does get it. Whenever we discuss tax credits, the conversation gets complicated very quickly, and we want to ensure that there's some fear that the amendments may have the effect of yanking tax credits from people that already believe that they have them and are in the process of being pre-certified and perhaps applying or are using them in their financing for project development. So we will have further discussion of this issue in the Committee on Revenue, where wonks like Representative Bentz can best address those kinds of issues.
Thank you, Representative. And to be clear, we heard a lot of testimony today about the amendments, and we're not voting on the amended bill. We're voting on the original bill. And thank you for that clarification. Is there other are there other comments on this bill? If not, I will ask Sue to call the roll once again.
Representative
Bentz. Aye.
Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Witt?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bailey?
Aye.
Co-Chair
Aye. And the motion passes. And I will close the work session on House Bill 4166. Lastly, colleagues, we need to go back to a bill that we had discussed earlier, and this, as you know, is the bewitching hour for first chamber bills, and that's why we are seeing it now. And I would entertain a motion on House Bill. Well, I first, of course, would open the work session on House Bill 4038 and entertain a motion on same bill.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to House Bill 4038 dated 2/3/12.
Co-Chair Bailey moves to adopt the dash one amendments dated February 3rd. 2012. Is there any discussion? And I hope there is, Mr. Co-Chair, because I'd like you to put this into perspective for us.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We have a couple of amendments here. The dash one amendment is, as you might recall, colleagues, we had a bill here that was a combination of several issues, some of which got moved into House Bill 4079 and moved out of the committee. House Bill 4038 is the residual of some important technical changes that we're making to House Bill 3672 from last session that have to do with the qualified research activities and tax credit, fire insurance premiums, and the film and video tax credit. This will head to the Committee on Revenue. Obviously, the details of those particular tax credits are not quite in the purview of this committee, and the Committee on Revenue can examine those in more detail. Those are contained within the Dash 1 amendments, and At the risk of jumping the gun to the next motion, you will also hear dash two amendment that adds in the extension on the farm worker housing credit that we heard testimony on in this committee, and that combined bill will go to the Committee on Revenue for further discussion.
Thank you for that clarification. Any other discussion here? Representative Benz.
Chair, are we discussing just the dash ones or the dash ones and the dash twos?
I am allowing discussion on both at the precedent of my co-chair.
Then, Mr. Chair, I'll be voting for both, but with the understanding, of course, that I get to vote on this again. And I of course, support the farm worker housing tax credit, but I also recognize that through a lot of hard work, we put together a process of addressing these in a context of a broader discussion. And I'm looking forward to that, to continue that type of dialogue when this arrives in revenue.
Duly noted, and thank you for your support in moving this along for further work. Other comments? Seeing none, is there any objection to this dash one amendment? Seeing none, the dash one amendment is adopted. I would entertain another motion, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mr. Co-Chair, I move we adopt the dash two amendments to House Bill 4038 dated 2312. These are the farm worker housing.
Thank you. Co-Chair Bailey moves to adopt the dash two amendments dated 2312 to House Bill 4038. Is there any discussion, further discussion, actually, on this amendment? Seeing none, if there's no objection, then those dash two amendments are adopted as well. And?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 4038 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Co-Chair Bailey moves House Bill 4038 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion on this now amended bill? Seeing none, I will ask Sue to call the roll on this bill.
Representative
Benz? Aye.
Representative
Penny Geyer? Aye.
Representative Thompson?
Aye.
Representative Wicks?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Co-Chair Bailey?
Aye.
Co-Chair Gillis?
Aye. And the motion passes. Colleagues, there's one more agenda item, because I'm going to go back, not and open up a public work session, unless Beth thinks I need to, a public hearing, excuse me. But I do want to have one last comment or discussion so that folks know what my intention is and my co-chair's intention on a bill that we heard extensively today but have heard before, and that is this House Bill 4078. I'm going to open up this quick discussion, and I'm going to ask you if you would also, please. All right, then I'm going to reopen a public hearing to make sure we're on the record properly on House Bill 4078. And to say this, and I want to echo and just say a couple other words, I want to echo Representative Witt's comments during the testimony. I believe in the potential of this bill. I am not satisfied with the previous hearing that we had and the discussions about why we didn't get this handled in the interim regarding rulemaking. The problem, I think, is even worse. I'm not going to go through the Jobs speech that everybody goes through because I think we're all of one mind. But the reason I think the problem is worse on this bill is that our neighbor to the south, we alluded to this in the other testimony, California has fast-tracked this very same issue of solar siting. And we're going to lose people who are interested if we don't knuckle down and get to business. And they're going to go down there and do the solar siting. And we're missing out. And I appreciate my co-chair helping me work through a very difficult and politically charged issue. And so I believe that we can continue to work on this and get to a resolution that actually gets something sited and gets some jobs going around what I call solar on the rocks in Oregon. So I'm not giving up on this. I'm very disappointed that we didn't get there, but I'm going to let my co-chair have the last word because I appreciate very much his teamwork on this issue.
Well, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair, and I would echo everything that you said. I think this is a great example of how clean energy in this state has become a jobs issue and an economic development issue and not a partisan issue. And I share absolutely the desire to move forward on this and to ensure that we are fast-tracking siting and that we have rules that have been adopted that will get us to a place where we are the most competitive state in the nation for investment in clean energy and Oregon jobs. We hired a commitment to move on the record to move the acreage limit to at least 250. We will hold the rulemaking process to that commitment. And for the wildlife portions that arose late in this process, we will be, and I'm speaking for you now, the co-chair and I are announcing that we are going to hold a work group during the interim where we will find a solution on the wildlife provisions to make sure that we are able to have a process that is functional, that works well, and that is something that all of us can get behind. So,
and if I can, speaking for you, every single member of this committee's input on that work group, verbal or otherwise, is welcome, as well as your involvement in the work group itself. If you're interested in that at any level, I hope you will let my co-chair and myself know. Now, I said I'd give him the last word, but I didn't want to cut any other member off on this subject if anybody else has anything to say about it.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Sign me up for the work group.
Excellent. You are signed up. So, with yes, please, Representative Kilgarry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just sign me up at least as a cheerleader. I very much appreciate the intent. I really appreciate the testimony that was given. I hope we're able to fast-track this. I understand why they need to do it through rules rather than through statute, but I really just want to go on record as saying I very much support the intention of this legislation.
Thank you very much for those comments. With that, I'm going to close that public hearing that I reopened for the second time on House Bill 4078. And if there's no other announcements for the committee, the House Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water is adjourned.